Pentagon watchdog says Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth could have endangered troops by sharing details of an attack in a group chat. We'll hear from the journalist added to that chat, Jeffrey Goldberg, on Morning Edition from NPR News. Vaccine advisors at the CDC have a new leader who is affiliated with a group still recommending ivermectin to treat COVID. I'm Steve Inske.
And I'm Michelle Martin. What changes is he planning to the way children get vaccinated? Also, American veterans fear those delays in processing asylum claims for Afghans will prove deadly for the allies left behind. It is Thursday, December 4th. It's a big day for musicians. Rapper and producer Jay-Z is 56. Hip-hop and country star Jelly Roll is 41. And singer-songwriter Jin of BTS is 33. News is next.
Live from NPR News, I'm Janine Herbst. President Trump says he'll release video of the second U.S. strike on an alleged drug boat off the coast of Venezuela. NPR's Mara Liasson has more.
The U.S. strikes on a boat the White House says was carrying drugs has caused controversy after reports that there were survivors after the first strike and that those survivors were killed in a second strike. President Trump said he would certainly release the video of the second strike, but that he's not sure what the U.S. government has on tape. The president continues to justify the attacks, saying that the boats the U.S. has been attacking are filled with drugs headed for the U.S. He claims that every boat the U.S. destroys saves 25,000 American lives, a number that experts say is substantially overstated. He also said the U.S. would soon be conducting strikes against Venezuelan drug traffickers on land. Mara Liasson, NPR News, The White House.
The New York Times is suing the Pentagon and its chief, Pete Hegseth, over restrictions saying he's violating First Amendment protections for a free press and freedom of speech by imposing a new policy with restrictions on reporting about the military. NPR's David Folkenflik has more.
Hegseth's policy is so sweeping that it bans reporters with press passes even from disclosing unauthorized information that is not classified. The Times and NPR and other major news outlets turned in their badges rather than agree to such conditions. Earlier this year, reporters broke stories challenging the official line on U.S. strikes on Iranian nuclear sites and on Venezuelan boats. A scoop by The Atlantic led an inspector general to conclude that Hegseth's group chat on Signal about pending U.S. airstrikes in Yemen could have placed American troops in harm's way. This week, the Pentagon has welcomed in a replacement press corps. They include pro-MAGA social media influencers and online conspiracy peddlers. David Folkenflik, NPR News, Washington.
Officials in Minnesota are pushing back against President Trump's comments on the Somali community in the state, some 80,000 strong, when he called them, quote, garbage. Minneapolis Mayor Jacob Frey.
He's wrong, and we want them here. Somali people have been an extraordinary benefit.
Trump says he doesn't want them in the country, and there are reports that ICE agents will target the Somali community in the Twin Cities. Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik has more.
Jaylani Hussein, who leads the Minnesota chapter of the Council on American-Islamic Relations and was born in Somalia, came here as a child, said that the community has reported already seeing an increased presence of immigration and customs enforcement personnel in the Twin Cities. He also said he's received reports of American citizens being asked about their citizenship. Hussein says this is blatantly discriminatory.
Minnesota Public Radio's Matt Sepik reporting. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Billionaire private astronaut Jared Isaacman was back on Capitol Hill yesterday for a second Senate hearing to become the head of NASA. President Trump initially picked him to head the space agency, but abruptly pulled the nomination shortly before confirmation. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce has more.
Jared Isaacman said he wouldn't speculate about why the president renominated him. One senator asked about donations to Trump's super PAC, but Isaacman said it shouldn't be surprising that he supported the Republican Party and that he donated far more to charitable causes. Pressed on his connections to SpaceX and Elon Musk, he said he was independent.
In a world where everybody has a phone with a camera on it, there are no pictures of us at dinner, at a bar, on an airplane, or on a yacht because they don't exist.
He stressed the urgency of returning Americans to the moon before a rival, China, gets there. Nell Greenfield-Boyce, NPR News.
A federal vaccine advisory committee meets today on whether newborns should still get the hepatitis B vaccine, the first shot found to prevent cancer. Federal health recommendations now suggest all babies be vaccinated against the liver infection in their first day of life. But Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s committee is expected to change that. That has some medical and public health experts alarmed because changing the recommendation would contradict previous public health advice. It's not clear what the committee is considering, but the American Academy of Pediatrics says it will still urge a birth dose. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include BritBox, committed to helping viewers unbox the unexpected over the holidays with British TV, including original series Lindley and a new season of Karen Peary. Streaming at BritBox.com.
Welcome to MN90, Minnesota History in 90 Seconds.
For centuries, Dakota, Ojibwe, and other indigenous growers in Minnesota preserved seeds after each growing season. Each kernel carried memories of place, family, and survival. Seed saving wasn't just about farming. It was about responsibility, a way to ensure that future generations would never go hungry, even after floods, droughts, or displacement. In the 19th and 20th centuries, as industrial agriculture spread and hybrid crops took over, these traditional practices were pushed aside, but they never disappeared. Indigenous elders and seed keepers quietly held on, protecting ancient varieties of corn, beans, squash, and more. Today, communities and local libraries across Minnesota are reviving the practice of seed saving. Many now host seed libraries, where residents can check out seeds, grow them, and return new ones after harvest. The White Earth Seed Library collects ancestral seeds along with the stories behind them. And Dream of Wild Health receives seeds from across the country to help rematriate varieties back to their tribal nations.
MN90 is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities. Made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund. Online at mn90.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. At the start of this week, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth faced intense scrutiny over a U.S. attack on an alleged drug boat in the Caribbean.
Now, an investigation criticizes a past action, the way that Hegseth shared highly sensitive attack plans for airstrikes against Yemen back in March. That was the attack that Hegseth discussed in a group chat that included the journalist Jeffrey Goldberg of The Atlantic. In a few minutes, we'll bring Mr. Goldberg into the chat here. First, what the government investigator said about Hegseth.
NPR National Security Correspondent Greg Myrie is covering this, and he's with us now. Good morning, Greg, to you.
Hi, Michelle.
So where is this new report coming from?
Yeah, this report comes from the Pentagon's Inspector General, who says Hegseth risked endangering U.S. troops by using the Signal messaging app to share military plans before the first attack in Yemen. Now, NPR has not seen the report, but we've been in touch with people who have, and they've described it on condition of anonymity. The report says Hegseth shared information labeled secret as he described details of the U.S. bombing campaign that was just about to begin against the Houthis in Yemen. This report, which is expected to be released publicly today, says Hegseth violated Pentagon rules by using a personal phone for official business.
And would you remind us, who was Hegseth sharing this information with?
Yeah, he was in contact with essentially all top national security officials, the CIA director, director of national intelligence, the national security advisor, the secretary of state. And as we noted, what none of them knew was that Jeffrey Goldberg, the editor of The Atlantic, was inadvertently included and was reading the messages as well. Now, he didn't report the contents in real time, but did so days later when that U.S. bombing campaign was well underway in Yemen. All of these senior government officials at work and at home have rooms where they can communicate securely on government systems known as SCIFs, a sensitive compartmented information facility. And this is what all of them should have been using. Instead, they were on Signal, a publicly available app anyone can download. It encrypts messages and is considered quite good, but it can be hacked.
And would you remind us of what Hegseth said in these messages.
Yeah, Hegseth gave the exact times the U.S. military was launching F-18 warplanes, drones, and Tomahawk missiles at Yemen. And then he provided updates on when these weapons would begin to strike inside Yemen. And this was the start of a bombing operation against the Houthis that lasted for weeks, and it ended when Houthi attacks diminished against commercial ships in the Red Sea.
Did the Pentagon's Inspector General speak to Hegseth?
So the report says Hegseth gave a written response but would not sit for an interview. Hegseth provided a few of his signal messages, but the report relied on screenshots that Jeffrey Goldberg published in The Atlantic. Hegseth also denied that he shared classified information, saying he has the authority to declassify information, which is true. He can do that. But the report did not say whether he took any action to do so before sharing the material.
And before we let you go, what is the White House saying about this?
They're saying that, quote, no classified information was leaked and operational security was not compromised. President Trump stands by Secretary Hegseth.
That is NPR's Greg Meyer. Greg, thank you.
Sure thing, Michelle.
And I want to mention NPR CEO Catherine Marr also chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. Its subsidiary makes the Signal app.
Jeffrey Goldberg is on the line with us. He is editor-in-chief of The Atlantic and is the journalist added to that Signal group chat detailing attacks in Yemen. Jeffrey, good morning.
Good morning.
I thought of reaching out to you on Signal this morning, but thought better.
I haven't heard that joke before.
I'm sure you haven't, not at all. Does this finding sound about right to you, that Hegseth shared sensitive information that could have endangered a military operation?
Yes, exactly. And it's interesting that there's still an inspector general in the government who's willing to call out the boss. I thought that was unusual. It's very obvious, and it was obvious to me all along, that this was highly secret information being shared in this chat. There were two problems with the chat. One, that it was happening in a commercial messaging app. And the second was that they didn't know who they had added into the chat, namely me, and, you know, violating basic rules of good digital hygiene. The finding sounds, again, we haven't seen the full report. I haven't read the full report yet, but the finding seems basically accurate. This was information that could have endangered the lives of American service people because he was putting out real-time information about upcoming bombing runs. Upcoming is the important point.
Absolutely. Like anything ceases to be classified after an operation, possibly, but before an operation is the most sensitive time. Now, you mentioned the Inspector General. I'll give his name, Stephen A. Stebbins. I've been looking him up. He's been promoted across both the Trump and Biden administrations. He's been around for a while. And we should just remind people that the Trump administration fired a bunch of inspectors general early in the administration, but it appears that there are still some left who are willing to say what they think happened.
Right, exactly. And I do find that unusual. What's not unusual is that the administration is behaving as if this was not a leak of classified information. It is true that the Secretary of Defense has declassification power, but to say that the information that he was sharing is not secret and was not sensitive is absurd.
Well, let's get into the statement that has been made in response. Sean Parnell, Pentagon spokesperson, in responding to this news, calls it, quote, a total vindication, adds case closed. What do you think of that?
I think they think that we're very stupid. We, the citizens of the United States. That's obviously a silly statement. There's no exoneration here. Everyone with a phone understands that it's a mistake to be providing information to group chats, even non-sensitive information to group chats, that you don't know the participant. You don't know the names of the participants. But it's doubly absurd. I think you don't have to be an expert in national security to know that if you're putting into a general chat the timing of an upcoming bombing run where American pilots are going to be over hostile territory, if you don't think that that's sensitive and should not be shared in an insecure platform, I don't know what to tell you. They obviously believe that they can kind of bull their way through this and just say, nothing to see here, please move along. But the inspector general, like most Americans studying this, said, no, there's obviously a problem here, and you guys need to go fix your problem.
And I guess we'll note that Secretary Hegseth himself has also posted on social media that he sees this as total exoneration. You called for accountability when you were on this program earlier in the year talking about what had just happened at that point. What would accountability look like other than this report, which lays out what the Inspector General feels happened?
Well, the only thing I would say on that is that if this had been a lower-ranking civilians in the government or military officers of lower rank in the Army, Air Force, Marines, Navy, if they had shared information that was 1/100th as sensitive as this information over a commercial messaging app, the civilians would be fired, the military officers or enlisted personnel would be court-martialed. There are rules governing the sharing of sensitive, classified, secret information, and those rules are applied to people of lower rank.
It strikes me that you think that whether this material was specifically classified or not is not really relevant. It was clearly sensitive information, bottom line, and something should have happened as a result.
It was obviously classified information when Hegseth and others put it onto Signal. I mean, you cannot fool us into thinking that this was not sensitive classified information. It is the most sensitive information the government possesses.
Jeffrey Goldberg is editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. Glad you joined us this morning. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And as we mentioned earlier, NPR CEO Catherine Marr chairs the board of the Signal Foundation. Its subsidiary makes the Signal app.
The Trump administration continues to remove incentives for electric vehicles and cleaner gas cars. The latest plan is to change fuel economy standards. Those are the rules that push automakers to produce cars with better gas mileage. NPR's Camila Domonoske reports.
Fuel economy standards have been on a bit of a roller coaster over the last few presidencies. The Obama White House made them much more strict. Then the first Trump White House rolled them back. The Biden presidency, with its focus on fighting climate change and reducing the use of oil, made them more ambitious again. Not really a surprise what happened yesterday. Here's President Trump sitting next to Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy in the Oval Office.
Now, under the new rules being issued today by Secretary Duffy, the Department of Transportation will rescind the Biden fuel economy prices. And I hate to say that because they were really not economy. They were really, anti-economy.
These rules require automakers to make new cars more efficient every year or face fines. The proposed new rules would reset standards to where they were in 2022, and then instead of requiring 2% improvements in efficiency each year, they'd require just 0.5%. Environmental and public health groups have called this a step backward for human health and the environment. President Trump framed it as a win for affordability. He argues that the technology needed to make cars more efficient drives up prices.
They were horrible what they were doing to the costs and actually making the car much worse.
Different types of clean car technology can cost more upfront, but economic analyses have found that's outweighed by how much drivers save on gasoline. This is still a proposal, now in the public comment phase. Once finalized, this policy shift is likely to boost the bottom lines of automakers who could sell as many big pickups as they like without worrying about penalties. Although, actually, the Trump administration already eased that worry. This summer, the One Big Beautiful Bill Act erased all the penalties for companies that fell short of these fuel economy standards. So in that sense, the rules were already irrelevant. So why change them? Well, the Trump administration is trying multiple tactics to make sure the policy changes stick even after a change in presidents, anticipating another twist of the roller coaster. Camila Domonoske, NPR News.
This is NPR News.
KEXE went on the air in 1976. This year, we lost federal funding like all of public media, but you have come forward. You have told us that KEXE matters. We're grateful for all of you, and especially for the folks that have been here from the beginning, people like Michael Goldberg and Gail Addison.
You know, for me and Gail, it's really been two things, a fabulous music education of all the music that we never imagined or knew anything about, and we're learning still every week. And then the other thing, of course, is that everybody we know through KEXE.
Yeah, we've made a lot of decisions in our life based on having access to this radio station. An extremely rare opportunity to learn a new skill and to share your love of music and to meet so many people through this station as well.
Support KEXE now. Text the word donate to 218-326-1234.
PR comes from this station. And from Focus Features, presenting Hamnet, directed by Chloe Zhao, starring Jesse Buckley and Paul Mescal, now playing in select theaters everywhere December 5th. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at Progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people at WTGrantFDN.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. What do American veterans think of the federal government's actions against Afghan refugees? The president responded last week after one Afghan national allegedly shot two National Guard members. President Trump froze the asylum process under which thousands of Afghans were granted asylum. Many of them had risked their lives to work for the United States, which is why some veterans now feel their allies are being abandoned. NPR's Brian Mann reports.
When Thomas Kaza deployed to Afghanistan in 2019 with the Green Berets, he served with a special unit of Afghans clearing IEDs and landmines.
The Afghans laid down their lives as pretty much four times the rate as a Green Beret did. So that's an incredible level of sacrifice as undertaken by those guys.
After the Taliban captured Kabul in 2021, Kaza was one of the U.S. veterans who scrambled to help Afghan comrades escape. His group, the 1208 Foundation, is trying to rescue roughly 1,000 Afghans still living under Taliban rule whose family members fought alongside U.S. Special Forces.
For the guys who are detected, the risk is catastrophically higher.
Under the Biden administration, tens of thousands of Afghan allies and their families were vetted and allowed into the U.S. But last week, one of those men, 29-year-old Rahmanullah Lakhanwal, who worked with the CIA, allegedly opened fire on two National Guard soldiers in Washington, D.C., leaving one dead, the other seriously wounded. Lakhanwal pleaded not guilty to murder and other charges. Hours after the attack, President Trump condemned the Afghan refugee effort.
We must now re-examine every single alien who has entered our country from Afghanistan under Biden.
The attack in D.C., followed by Trump's freeze on asylum claims, were devastating for Afghans like M, who worked for the U.S. Defense Department in Kabul before fleeing to the U.S.
Everyone is scared. It's so sad. It's scary.
M agreed to speak with NPR if we only identified her by an initial. She fears the U.S. government could strip her legal status. She also fears for the safety of family members still in Afghanistan. M says Afghans who worked with the U.S. left behind under the Taliban are in grave danger.
Everyone who are associated or work for the U.S., themselves plus their family are in trouble.
NPR heard over and over that delays in the Afghan refugee process could be deadly for U.S. allies. Muhammad worked as an interpreter for the U.S. military in Kabul and now helps organize asylum efforts.
We lost one person that he were arrested by the Taliban and beaten to the dead. He died. He lost his life. And we have his family that we're working on their paperwork to bring them over here.
Muhammad, too, agreed to be interviewed only if NPR concealed his full name because he fears for the safety of family members still in Afghanistan. Muhammad said if the U.S. leaves behind Afghans who served alongside American soldiers, it would send a grim message.
All the world will identify United States Army like a fair weather friend. They just use them, and after that, if their work is done, so they just abandoned them.
NPR reached out to the Defense Department to ask how Trump's freeze on asylum claims for America's Afghan allies might affect operations in future conflicts. A spokesman declined to comment. But U.S. military veterans leading the Afghan refugee effort say the policy could dissuade future allies. Sean Vandiver is a U.S. Navy veteran with the group Afghan EVAC.
They're going to point at what has happened with our Afghan allies and say, hell no, we're not going to help you. Look what you did.
Thomas Kaza, the former Green Beret, says he too thinks this policy could haunt the U.S.
Those future U.S. partners are going to know what is happening today. Everybody who partners with us is going to ask, hey, what happens when the Americans leave? And they're going to point to this.
Kaza says he still hopes to convince the Trump administration that America's Afghan allies paid a heavy price, earning a chance at life in the U.S. Brian Mann, NPR News.
The presidents of Rwanda and the Democratic Republic of Congo, the DRC, are in Washington, D.C. today to sign a deal brokered by the U.S. that's meant to end a conflict in which Rwandan-backed rebels have seized parts of eastern Congo. But Emmett Livingstone reports from the DRC's capital, Kinshasa, that serious differences between the two parties remain. Let me let you know here that you will hear gunfire in this piece.
In Congo, peace feels like a long way away. Since 2021, M23 rebels have captured huge swathes of territory, including strategic mines. Earlier this year, helped by thousands of troops from neighboring Rwanda, the M23 rebels seized eastern Congo's two largest cities. All-out war between Congo and Rwanda was on the table. But then, the Trump administration applied real pressure on both sides. In June, it brokered a peace deal, and President Trump hailed its success from behind the Resolute desk at the White House.
So we're here today to celebrate a glorious triumph, and that's what it is for the cause of peace. And this is a long time waiting.
There's an economic component to the deal. Both countries have agreed to cooperate on energy and mineral supply chains, hoping to eventually attract U.S. investment. Under the deal, Rwanda is required to pull its troops out of Congo, and Congo is supposed to eradicate an extremist militia that's hostile to Rwanda. The presidential signing ceremony is taking place, even though none of these conditions have been met.
It's the best chance for peace, stability and security between Rwanda and DRC, and for our region.
That's Yolande Makolo, Rwanda's government spokesperson, speaking to NPR in Washington. She denies Rwandan involvement in the M23 conflict, despite overwhelming evidence to the contrary, including from the UN and the US government.
The peace deal is not a magic wand. Peace comes in steps, and there have been important steps that have been taken since the signing in June.
Congo is also negotiating a separate peace deal with the M23 rebels. These parallel talks must succeed for the US-brokered peace deal to work. On the ground, though, fighting between the M23 and Congolese forces has continued. The rebels say they won't relinquish their captured territory, whereas the Congolese government says taking back control is non-negotiable.
Nous avons rendez-vous à Washington.
That's Congolese President Félix Tshisekedi a few days ago, telling supporters that the upcoming deal offers a chance at real peace.
Tout cela entrera en compte.
But he was also clear that peace means Rwandan troops leaving Congo for good. Despite President Trump's claims of having solved the conflict, eastern Congo is still very much at war. And once the cameras stop clicking on Trump's handshake with Presidents Tshisekedi and Kagame, the hardest part begins. Because no one knows if this deal will hold where it matters most, on the ground. For NPR News, I'm Emmett Livingstone in Kinshasa.
This is NPR News.
We hear the word ideology a lot these days. Both conservatives and liberals use the term, but people tend only to refer to something as an ideology if they disagree with it.
Ideology has essentially become a form of name-calling. It's a way of sort of saying you have ridiculous or stupid beliefs.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. How the meaning of ideology has changed on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear All Things Considered starting at 4 o'clock today here on People Powered KAXE. Your local host is Andrew DeZingle. It is 5:29. Good morning. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up in just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer will look back at his nature notes for this date, December 4th. Increasing clouds today, slight chance for snow, temperature 16 to 21, south winds 5 to 15. Increased chance of snow tonight with lows near 7. Tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the low 20s, slight chance of snow in the afternoon. For Friday night, our lows in the single digits above 0, and for Saturday, partly sunny, highs near 10. Itasca Waters continue their free Practical Water Wisdom webinar series today at noon. It's called Water Wishes for the Holidays. Presenters will share a joyful hour of water-themed children's books that spark curiosity. Register at itascawaters.org. The Clearwater County Historical Society in Shevlin has the Festival of Trees. You can enjoy more than 30 trees and vote for your favorite. Donations of non-perishable food items are encouraged. There are special events happening each weekend through December 21st. And Crosby has their community tree lighting this Friday, 5 o'clock in Marketplace Plaza. Enjoy hot chocolate and other goodies. And Grand Rapids Tax Aid is seeking volunteers for the upcoming tax season. They are looking for people to prepare taxes and those who would rather help in other ways. You can email taxaidgr@gmail.com. And Northwoods Friends of the Arts in Cook presents It Starts With an Idea. It's a multimedia exhibit by Mary Lou Ellison. There's an opening reception tomorrow from 5 to 7. Thanks so much for choosing KAXE this morning. It is time now for our daily dose of phonology. Here is John Latimer.
On today's date, December 4th, 2011, my wife Denise and I are out for a hike, and our eyes are captured by the bright red of the British soldiers' lichens, and these common and frequently overlooked lichens are quite gorgeous against the snow background. That little cap of red, which is absolutely scarlet, is really quite fantastical when you get a chance to see it against a background of all white snow. We enjoyed looking at the British soldier, the pale sage green structure that supports that bright red spore-producing body on the top of the lichen. It is very, very interesting to look at.
Groups, Andrea Hsu, NPR News.
I'm Dave Mattingly, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from MS Now, home to The Rachel Maddow Show, Morning Joe, The Briefing with Jen Psaki, and more, MS Now is a source for news, opinion, and the world. Learn more at ms.now. And from Fisher Investments, as a fiduciary, Fisher Investments is obligated to act in their client's best interest. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Vaccine advisors for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention meet today and tomorrow, and they're expected to question how pediatricians vaccinate children for more than a dozen diseases.
NPR Health correspondent Ping Huan is with us now to tell us more about it. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
What's this meeting about?
So this is the Advisory Committee on Immunization Practices. This is a panel that's been making recommendations on how vaccines should be used since 1964. And back in June, Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. dismissed all the previous members, and he replaced them with members who have shown that they are not, generally speaking, all that familiar with the details of vaccine policy or how this group shapes it. At their last meeting in October, the committee's chairman said that they were rookies when they had to redo a vote. That chairman was replaced just this week, and the new chair is Dr. Kirk Milhone. He's a pediatric cardiologist and a fellow with the Independent Medical Alliance, which is a group that still recommends people use drugs like ivermectin to treat COVID, even though studies have shown it does not work.
So what will be covered in this meeting?
So a few things. First of all, the group is going to be voting on whether to drop the recommendation that hepatitis B vaccines be given to babies at birth. This is a policy that's been in effect for more than 30 years. And it's something that came up at the last meeting, where some members wanted to push the vaccine back to when kids are older, and others said it would be a mistake. Now, since that meeting, independent researchers have found that delaying the Hep B vaccine by even a couple of months could lead to hundreds of preventable deaths each year. That's from liver cancers and health problems that are prevented by getting this $15 vaccine. Also, they're going to be discussing the overall vaccine schedule, which is who gets which vaccines and when, and also what goes into vaccines.
What are their concerns about the vaccine schedule?
So Milhone, the new committee chair, told the Washington Post that they're going to be looking into whether vaccines are causing asthma, eczema, and other autoimmune diseases in children. This is even though large long-term studies have found no evidence for this. Dr. Sean O'Leary with the American Academy of Pediatrics says that every vaccine on the schedule is vetted.
And it's based on the age at which a child's immune system can provide optimal protection after vaccination, balanced with the age the child is at highest risk for a disease.
Now, Kennedy has also enraged the public health community recently by ordering changes to the CDC's website, suggesting that vaccines, and specifically an ingredient containing aluminum, might cause autism. This is also not supported by scientific consensus, but it's also a topic for this meeting.
And just for folks who might be interested, why is aluminum in vaccines?
Yeah, so it's not the aluminum metal by itself. These are chemicals that contain aluminum, and they're used to boost the immune system to make the vaccine more effective. Now, they've been used in vaccines since the 1930s, and they're currently used in more than a dozen of them in very small amounts. But if these ingredients get banned, as some advocates have pushed for, there are no substitute vaccines without them that are ready to go. It could take years for replacements to be developed and to be made.
So there is a lot at stake in this meeting.
There is, yeah. And a lot of people in medicine, public health are going to be watching very closely. And while doctors' groups and some state health departments are making their own independent vaccine recommendations now, this panel still influences what insurance covers, and with these public meetings, they have a big megaphone to shape what people hear and think about vaccines.
That's NPR health correspondent Ping Huang. Ping, thank you.
You're welcome.
Our next guest is an epidemiologist. Micah Osterholm directs the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Welcome.
Yeah, thank you very much.
How important is this vote on delaying hepatitis B vaccines?
Well, Steve, I can tell you without any doubt in my 50 years in the business that this is probably the most defining moment for our country in public health. If they, in fact, vote down the hepatitis B recommendation today, where the science is clear and compelling and children's lives are at risk, this will mean we can no longer trust federal health authorities when it comes to vaccines, which has, as you know, been the actual standard bearer of vaccine science for all of these years. So this is a huge issue today.
Wow, a lot to follow up on there. First, why would delaying the hepatitis B vaccine by just a couple of months, but still giving the vaccine, make such a difference in its effectiveness? It doesn't sound like that big a deal.
Well, actually, it's a very big deal because the number one way in which the kids are infected with hepatitis B virus is actually exposure to blood during the birthing process to an infected mom.
Hmm.
And so the virus transmits at that point. If you can vaccinate literally at the time of delivery or shortly thereafter, as well as give a type of immune globulin we call HBIG, it's a antibody that will help also tie up the virus, you can actually prevent that transmission from occurring. So it's too late to wait months later to vaccinate the child. This is not about them getting exposed, you know, through sex and drugs, as has often been referred to as the reason why you don't need to vaccinate young kids. It's that transmission from an infected mom.
Hmm. You also said that if they take this vote, if they make this move in defiance of the science, that we can no longer trust HHS. We can no longer trust this committee. I had an opportunity to hear Robert F. Kennedy Jr. in a speech last month in Arizona. And in this speech, he accused people at his own agency of malpractice. He said, quote, they haven't been doing their job. He claims to represent people who don't trust the health agencies, and they're doing something about it. It seems to me that you are now flipping that around, and you're saying actually what the agency is doing now is what is endangering trust. Is that right?
Absolutely, and it's uniform across the world in terms of their response to what's happening. In fact, just yesterday in the New England Journal of Medicine, 12 former FDA commissioners from both Republican and Democratic administrations wrote a scathing article about what's happening right now at HHS and the whole challenge that has come to the advisory committee immunization practices. Countries across the world are also in the same position. And finally, let me just say, all of the various medical societies, whether it's be the American Academy of Pediatrics, American College of Obstetricians, Gynecologists, Infectious Disease Society of America, all are on the same side here. I've never seen a more unified public health situation than I do now. The one challenge, of course, is our own federal government is spreading mis- and disinformation that is causing parents not to vaccinate their children.
And we should note the government has already taken a large number of actions. We don't know how this committee is going to vote today, but suppose they take this vote, which for you is momentous and a Rubicon, and it means we can no longer trust the agency at all. If that happens, where would you have me turn for reliable information on vaccines for myself or my family?
I think at this point it's going to be the medical societies. And we did accomplish that very issue last fall when our group at the Vaccine Integrity Project at the University of Minnesota actually put together a body of detailed information on updating the COVID vaccines, the flu vaccines, and the RSV vaccines. And at that point, this medical society signed on, and we did come up with different recommendations that have been used.
Can go to those recommendations or go to our individual doctors, I suppose.
Exactly. That's where the most important information needs to be, is with the doctors to be able to share with their patients.
Dr. Michael Osterholm is director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota. Thank you, sir.
Thanks, Steve.
This is NPR News.
Hey, it's News Director Chelsea Perkins from KAXE, and we are celebrating. Because of you, we blew our Give to the Max Day fundraising goal out of the water. Your support does more than keep the lights on. It powers trusted local journalism, rooted right here in northern Minnesota. It helps our news desk tell the stories that matter, ask the questions that need to be asked, and amplify voices you don't hear anywhere else. Every dollar that you gave has quadrupled the power thanks to our participation in the National Newsmatch program through the Institute of Nonprofit News. This is an investment in people-powered news, community connection, and the future of public media. There's still time to support KAXE this year. You can make a year-end gift anytime through December 31st at kaxe.org. From all of us at KAXE, thank you for believing in local news. And thank you for making this work possible.
It's 5:43. Good morning. Thanks for listening to the Thursday morning show here on People Powered KAXE. I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:20, Heidi Holton will be speaking with our early bird fishing guide, Jeff Sundin. Kari Hedlund co-hosting this morning as well. We do have a slight chance of snow today. Increasing clouds, temperatures 16 to 21, winds from the south 5 to 15. Chance of snow this evening with lows near 7 and tomorrow. Mostly cloudy, highs in the low 20s, slight chance of snow in the afternoon. And for tomorrow night, mostly cloudy, lows in the single digits, and Saturday partly sunny, highs near 10. Area book lovers are invited to a book swap at the KBXC studio in Bemidji. Bring a book, take a book, or a few on Wednesday, December 10th, 5:30 to 7:30. You can also talk about your favorite books with fellow readers, staff, and What We're Reading host Tammy Bobrowski. There will be used books from the Red Door Bookstore available for purchase. Brainerd Community Theater presents Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer today through Sunday at the Chalberg Theater on the campus of Central Lakes College. Find tickets and showtimes at clcperformingarts.com. You can let us know what's happening in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxc.org. You can also look for events up north at our website. It's a list of what's happening each week.
Our comes from this station. And from Fidelity Investments, a dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. From Procter & Gamble, maker of ZzzQuil, with a range of products designed to relieve occasional sleeplessness to help people fall asleep. Learn more at ZzzQuil.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Michelle Martin. The New York Times is suing the Pentagon and Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth over the Pentagon's new media policy. The newspaper says the policy violates its constitutional rights and restricts press access in an effort to deprive the public of an independent understanding of military matters. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik is here in the studio, actually, to tell us more about this. Good morning.
Good morning, Michelle.
So tell us more about the lawsuit. What's in it?
So this stems back from a policy that was put in place in September from the defense secretary on down, and it says that reporters credentialed to report from inside the Pentagon can only seek and report out information that the Pentagon's leadership has formally approved for public release. And let's be really clear about this. This policy even forbids reporting and gathering unclassified information that the Pentagon brass hasn't permitted. New York Times says this is a violation of their First Amendment right, that is free speech and freedom of the press. The Times also alleges that this is a violation of the Due Process Clause of the Constitution, that is, it was kind of a decision pulled out of the air, and that they don't have a right to appeal it and say, challenge it and say, look, somebody else should be looking at whether or not this is fair.
So the policy isn't the only way that this administration has tried to limit news organizations covering the Defense Department. Say more about that, if you would. What's the pattern here?
So let's not forget, Pete Hegseth was a former star at Fox News. He was the co-host of the weekend show Fox and Friends, and that is really, although he's a former military veteran, that is really how he came to the president's attention. He's basically given the established press the Heisman. He is preferred to communicate through memes rather than press conferences or interviews with folks who try to provide an independent check on what the military does. They, earlier in the year, implemented restrictions on mobility for reporters around the buildings, implying somehow that people were skulking about to all corners and crevices of the five-cornered building known as the Pentagon. That's not really the case. They were fairly limited anyway. But it limited interaction between people who weren't at the top levels with regular reporters. And it's also part of a larger pattern, as you guys know, right? The Trump administration limited the Associated Press in ways that they had been able to do things previously. Trump, as a private citizen, sued ABC's parent company. He sued CBS's parent company, got significant payouts from them to settle those mm-hmm. lawsuits. The FCC's chairman under Trump has initiated essentially informal investigations of every broadcast network that the president has criticized, including our own. It's really all of a piece.
So just going back to the Pentagon now, basically the administration just wants the media organizations to be an extension of their press office. They basically want them to be their publicists, basically. So most news organizations, I'd say major legacy news organizations, including the Times and NPR, have refused to agree to this policy. Their credentials were revoked, or they turned them in. Have you seen it affect coverage of the Pentagon yet?
I think you're still seeing a lot of mainstream news organizations break stories, much to the consternation of folks at the Pentagon. You know, if you think back over just this year, the first year of the second Trump term, news organizations have broken major story contradicting the official line. Think of strikes on the Iranian nuclear sites. Think of more recently the strikes on Venezuelan boats. Most recently, Inspector General came out with a conclusion that the Pentagon Secretary Hegseth could have endangered American troops' lives by engaging in an unsafe signal chat that was broken by the editor-in-chief of The Atlantic. And what you're also seeing is, you know, the effort to do that outside the Pentagon while sycophants are being brought in, conspiracy theorists and pro-MAGA online influencers. It's a very different press corps right now.
That is NPR's David Folkenflik. David, thank you so much.
You bet.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Michelle Martin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
Green Cheese listeners know how important it is to support stations like KAXE KBXE.
Anyone who can, be sure to donate, because as all of us know, we listen to this Green Cheese and all the other programming on the stations. We really, really love it and don't want anything to happen to it. So it's really important to give what you can.
One thing I wanted to do is I wanted to talk to everybody out there. Radio is important when it's unique and it's interesting and it's local. And given your current funding situation, everybody out there should be doing something about that, no matter how little it is. If everybody did something, it makes a tremendous difference. Think about Saturday nights with no green cheese. That sounds terrible.
It would be so boring.
This is the queen, and I'm going to make an edict. All cheeses, get your checkbooks out and send in some money to our favorite station and show, and my check will be in the mail tomorrow.
Donate now at KAXE.org.
Might we soon look up into the night sky to see a crescent or round-shaped economy?
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Odoo, dedicated to providing software designed to scale with businesses. Odoo's programs for manufacturing, accounting, and more aim to provide building blocks for creating a custom software suite. Odoo, what businesses need.
I'm David Brancaccio in Los Angeles. First, the front of your ID card, including driver's license. Does it have the little star shape indicating it's a real ID? More today on TSA Airport Security announcing people with an ID but without real ID will soon have to pay a $45 fee. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams has more.
Most current driver's licenses are real IDs, which meet higher federal security standards.
There have been 17 years for people to get compliant with real ID.
Janice Kephart is CEO of identity compliance firm ZipID and consulted on the 9/11 commission that spawned the stricter identity requirements.
It's only about 6% of people might not be presenting a real ID or a biometric equivalent at this point. So it's a pretty small percentage.
And who are those folks? Mostly people who don't travel much by air, says Ifeanyi Davis of Louisiana Appleseed Center for Law and Justice.
This can also be really difficult or challenging for people who have missing birth records, for people who are dealing with the legality around their name change.
Critics of the new fee say most people will probably just pay to finally get their real IDs rather than deal with the hassle, which is kind of the point, says the TSA's Steve Lorenz.
For us, the big push is security. The big push is compliance. The big push is for people to get their real ID.
But if they don't, starting February 1st, they'll either need to pay the fee online in advance or expect to spend even more time going through security at the airport. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
The $45 fee will be good for 10 days of travel. So for trips longer than that, passengers with ID but not real ID would pay again. Passports are among a short list of documents that will still work at airport security without the fee. This is all come February. Markets, S&P and NASDAQ futures are little changed now, with a key reading on inflation due tomorrow. The Financial Times is reporting now that the U.S. stopped a plan to hit China's spy agency with sanctions in order to keep trade negotiations moving forward. forward. The planned sanctions have been designed to respond to a massive cyber espionage campaign that had targeted top U.S. officials. The FT's reporting suggests this was also about the U.S. not disrupting imports of China's rare earth minerals.
Marketplace Morning Report is supported by Fidelity Investments. A dedicated advisor can help build a flexible wealth plan. Learn more at fidelity.com/wealth. Investment minimums apply. Fidelity Brokerage Services, LLC. And by Palo Alto Networks. Palo Alto Networks delivers what's next in cybersecurity innovation to protect today's digital way of life. Learn more at paloaltonetworks.com.
As you gaze up at this evening's supermoon, up to 14% larger seeming and 30% brighter, don't get greedy. To quote Article 2 of the Outer Space Treaty of 1967, outer space, including the moon, is not subject to national appropriation by claim of sovereignty, by means of use or occupation, or by any other means. So you can't do a land grab up there, but you can conduct business on the moon. This week here, multiple views of an emerging moon economy, how it might work, and if it's even a good idea. Christina Guidi is Assistant General Manager for Space Technology and Transportation at a nonprofit entity called the Aerospace Corporation. Among the many projects, it coordinates how people and machines might communicate with each other on the moon.
What we are doing in partnership with NASA for their Artemis missions is creating LunaNet, which is essentially a communications and navigation architecture or system that allows us to communicate to rovers, as you mentioned, also to orbiting spacecraft and astronauts on the surface of the moon from Earth and to each other while they're on the lunar surface.
What about knowing where you are on the moon? I think some of my listeners will be ahead of me on this, right? But the GPS system that we use for our maps to work on our phone involve satellites around Earth. It's probably not going to help you if you're on the moon.
That's what this LunaNet is going to help do, is actually provide that situational awareness of where you are, your position, and allow for navigation of the different assets and astronauts as well. So it's a critical infrastructure that we need to put in place for Artemis to be sustainable.
Yeah, I mean, the infrastructure would include, I don't know, structures, building on the moon. It's a lot cheaper if you can build with stuff that's actually already on the moon. And what that mainly is that lunar dirt. I guess there's promise there of turning that into usable stuff.
That's a key area. In situ resource utilization includes using the lunar regolith to construct structures, to convert the lunar regolith into water and air. There's a lot on the lunar surface that we could actually exploit. But you also have to think about, we have to have power, right? Where are we going to get our power from? We need robotic or mobility devices that would actually push the regolith around to create a landing pad.
I mean, on the side facing the sun, you can use solar, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we're also looking at fission nuclear power sources. So we've got several companies actually developing systems that can actually be deployed on the lunar surface just for that reason, so that it can actually operate during the lunar night.
Chris, I got a favor, though. When you're in meetings coordinating a lunar economy to come, can you tell them not to make a mess? I mean, there are environmental concerns.
Oh, absolutely. But one thing we need to consider looking forward is, how do we take the leftover materials or hardware and reuse it? So that would be a technology that needs to be developed across the community to repurpose material that is not used completely. That's something that needs to be considered in the future for sure.
Christina Guidi is Assistant General Manager for the Space Technology and Transportation Subdivision in the Human Exploration and Spaceflight Division at Aerospace Corporation. Thank you for the conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Now, tomorrow here, I'll speak to a professor of religion and science studies more about these ethical and environmental concerns if the moon were to be developed. Our interviews are accumulating at marketplace.org. We also have a new video up about what I learned about the stock market by building and launching big amateur rockets. You can search Marketplace APM on TikTok, Facebook, Instagram, and there it is. In Los Angeles, I'm David Brancaccio with our morning report from APM, American Public Media.
It's just before 6 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXE Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXE Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We're people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. We invite you to join us at KAXE.org. Good morning, I'm Jennifer Barr. Coming up at 6:20, our early bird fishing guide, Heidi Holton and Kari Headland, your hosts this morning. Support comes from Sanford Health with primary care locations in Bemidji and across the Upper Midwest. Sanford Health is committed to providing care close to home. Learn more at sanfordhealth.org. Increasing clouds today, slight chance for snow. Temperatures 16 to 21, winds from the south 5 to 15. Chance of snow increases this evening, lows near 7. And for tomorrow, mostly cloudy, highs in the low 20s. Slight chance of snow in the afternoon, highs on Saturday near 10 above.
Good morning. For the second straight